Everybody take your seats.
It's on.
It's on? Okay.
Okay. Here? Okay. Great. Okay. Maybe let's do testing. Can you hear me? I know my voice is kind of low, so I'll probably have to talk louder. Can people hear me on Zoom?
Can you switch the Zoom to the view for the gallery?
Wait. And I wanted to start with a land acknowledgement before we begin our Zed talk today. And our Zed talk that Hara Kamal and I are doing is Hope is a Discipline. And in the context of our work on the downtown east side, as it intersects with the overdose crisis, the drug poisonings, surplus suffering, and Buddhist practice. I will talk louder.
Yeah.
Okay.
Please move in closer so you can hear.
So it is with great gratitude that we in what is called Vancouver gather on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations, who have stewarded these lands and continue to steward these lands from time immemorial. I offer this land acknowledgement today as a second-generation Canadian, as a Black woman of mixed heritage, as a settler, and as someone who works in healthcare. It is important for me to reflect on my ongoing connection with these lands, ways I can be a better Indigenous ally, and ongoing ways to decolonize myself and the systems I work in. As a Buddhist practitioner, I believe that being present to what is, rooted in an ethic of love, is an invitation to engage more skillfully and compassionately in the world, and that engaged practice can provide pathways to reconciliation and healing.
In the Zen tradition, it is common that we acknowledge our Dharma lineage ancestors. We would like to acknowledge that these teachings have been carried as a lineage by Asian ancestors, communities, and cultures. Great gratitude for our spiritual ancestors. Without them, we would not have these teachings.
So I wanted to begin by reading a poem from June Jordan in Black Nature, Four Centuries of African American Nature Poetry. For Alice Walker, a summertime Tonka. Redwood, grove, and war. You and me talking Congo, gender, grief, and ash. I say God is also huge, and you say these trees, these sweet trees, this tree.
That was wonderful. Angela, can you share why you chose this for this talk, for this poem for this talk?
Yeah, when I read this poem and was thinking about the drug poisoning crisis, my initial thought was, God, this is all so huge. And I sometimes forget about the sweetness. I sometimes forget about the goodness. So that is, that's why I wanted to start with this poem. And to give a little bit of a background, in April 2016, BC's provincial health officer declared a public health emergency due to the increase in opiate overdose-related deaths. The unregulated drug poisoning deaths are not only associated with opiates. COVID-19 and the unregulated drug supply has impacted both stimulant and opiate users. And 6 years later, since this crisis was declared, as of April 2023, 11,807 people have died in this province. And that is an average of 6 deaths per day. And when these numbers came out, I cried, and I continue to feel sadness. And I recognize that, you know, Harkamal, we work on, you know, in our work on the downtown east side, but I also want to acknowledge those who have lived life experience, those who have lost people that they care about, and people who have lost people in their in their communities. So we know that 71% of the people who have died were between the ages of 30 and 59, and 77% were male. We also know that there is a higher disproportionate number of Indigenous folks who have died. The legacy of colonization, intergenerational trauma, dislocation from community and culture, which all impact mental health and addiction. And what is often reported is the numbers, and I think it's really important to recognize that these are people who left community, family, and friends behind. And it's hard not to feel overwhelming anger and sadness. And in my role, I'm a social worker. I'm also a team lead for a mobile mental health outreach team for a local health authority. And for far too many people that I have worked with have died from drug poisonings. And some of these folks were actively involved in their communities and the areas of harm reduction. Many were generous and kind despite experiencing material poverty, creative and resilient, and had a good sense of humor. And these individuals were fiercely independent, struggling against stigma and stereotypes and various forms of oppression. And like all beings, they wanted to be happy and live with dignity and in safety. And despite the multitude of challenges on the downtown east side, I know that for many folks that I work with and who live there, it is one of the few communities where they truly feel accepted.
So I've spent the last 13 years working as a clinical counselor out of an inner city clinic in the downtown east side community, where I still continue to work. I am one small part of a larger interdisciplinary team that provides support for vulnerable folks in the community that Angela described, who present often with, at least at this clinic I work out of, with usually some pretty complex medical issues, of course, too, but a lot of social barriers and needs as well. And these social needs and barriers are intricately linked with their mental health as well, which is often where I come in terms of providing a safe, non-judgmental therapeutic space, often to bear witness to their stories, and also to provide forms of treatment and support as well, just based on out of my own trainings and such as well too. But a lot of my training is also often taken from the cushion here too. As you were mentioning, Angela, the deaths from the poison drug supply, it often, whenever I hear that, no matter when, a space of grief always opens up in me, even right now too. I'm just my heart weighs heavy, because just over the years I've spent in the community, I've just formed so many relationships, and many of them have passed away and continue to pass away as well from the poison drug supply. A person that I might see tomorrow, that might be the last time I'll see them, and this is something that I've come to encounter, just that reality of that fleeting experience of meeting people too, which comes with our work too. Yet I also feel grateful for it is these relationships and the ties to the community that also sustains me, and I'm gonna unpack that as we talk too. This reminds me of the many ways this community upholds each other with compassion and solidarity in the midst of so much loss, and just resisting those effects of oppression too. You can't help but be sustained by that in terms of witnessing it too. I know many can sometimes associate, especially with the media and the portrayal of the community too, with certain ideas, but it's there's just so much compassion too at the same time. Angela, I really, just really appreciate what you said about feeling grateful for the relationships you have had and how the community upholds each other too.
And I think about, like, you and I had met over a coffee a few months ago to start the process of this talk, and I also am very grateful for being able to do this talk with you, because I've learned a lot from you during this process, and it's also been sort of, for me too, like, healing to do this with you. And I recognize the importance of Sangha and community, which you are a part of, so thank you for that. And when we had met over a coffee a few months ago, probably a bit longer than that, I was at a bit of a low point, and I had listened to a talk by Angela Davis, and a New York Times article described Angela Davis this way: before the world knew what intersectionality was, this scholar, writer, and activist was living it, arguing not just for Black liberation, but for the rights of women and queer and transgender people as well. She is 79 years old, and I continue her to be an elder and an inspiration, because she has been doing social justice work for the long haul. And she referenced an educator and activist, Miriam Kiba, in this talk that she was doing, and she said the phrase, hope is a discipline. Mm-hmm. And that's something that really stuck with me. And just to say a little bit more about that, Miriam Kiba said, it's work to be hopeful. It's not like this fuzzy feeling, like you have to actually put energy and time, and you have to be clear about it, and you have to hold fast to having a vision. It's hard, it's a hard thing to maintain, but it matters to have it, to believe that it's possible to change the world. So the hope is a discipline mantra has been in my head, and it ended up being an inspiration for this talk. And with continuing with this theme of hope, I wanted to share something from Joan Halifax, who's the founder of Upaya Zen Center, and she makes she looks at hope, ordinary hope, and wise hope. And she says, as Buddhists, we know that ordinary hope is based on desire, wanting an outcome that could be different from what will actually happen. Not getting what we hope for is usually experienced as some kind of misfortune. Sometimes someone who is hopeful in this way has an expectation, and that kind of always hovers in the background, the shadow of fear that one's wishes will not be fulfilled. This ordinary hope is a subtle expression of fear and a form of suffering. There is oppression and a range of injustice, but understand, wise hope doesn't mean denying any of these realities. It means facing them, addressing them, and remembering what else is present, like the shifts in our values that recognize and move us to address suffering right now.
Yeah, I just really, really appreciated that, just that quote by Joan Halifax, just acknowledging the distinction between ordinary hope and wise hope. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
It also makes me think too about what are the causes and conditions for hope as a discipline to be sort of nurtured and ripened, and to be hopeful in a wise and a skillful and compassionate way. And I remember when we were talking at JJB, and you talked about the importance of looking after yourself.
That's
and
right.
Like, I think for myself anyways, there's no way that I can be hopeful at all without actually, like, if I'm depleted all the time, I can't even imagine sort of pulling hope out.
Yeah, the reality of continuing in this kind of work is that you will be consistently depleted. We have to acknowledge that working within systems that perpetuate or exacerbate the very issues faced by marginal folks will lead to always a sense of hopelessness. That's that unfortunately is the reality as well. Like an example might be the lack of a much needed safe supply of drugs right now. Despite the calls from numerous organizations, it's still not happening. And people are dying.
I would also add, and safe and dignified housing and, you know, ready access to treatment and detox and all, like, there's a long list of things.
Thank you. It's hard not to have our hope robbed as we witness how it's harming the people we are meant to bring hope to. How do you sustain that? How can you work that as a discipline? When I brought up the notion of looking out after yourself, I was referring it in those contexts. We are all intricately connected in these contexts of systemic violence, and we are all physically, mentally, spiritually harmed. For myself, sustaining my practice of Zazen is a radical form of attending to that suffering, that harm too. I don't treat it as self-care. I'm very cautious of using that term as well. I don't mean that also in a striving way of escaping or avoiding pain and anger. In order for me to have the awareness that I am drowning and need support, or to have that vision of what hope looks like, I need a practice that helps to cultivate that awareness and to tend to that pain with compassion and equanimity. It also provides me with awareness to know my body's limitations and when to provide it even with rest. And I don't refer to rest in this trendy escapist striving, even this capitalist notion, I'm going to go away on a spa retreat sort of way, which there is nothing wrong with that too at the same time, because I talk about it more in terms of bringing awareness to my body that has been harmed, providing it loving attention, and fostering sustainability in the midst of hopelessness. When we were talking that day in that coffee shop, more than once, about a liberating power of rest, I shared with you how rest was actually a practice focus of mine during the practice period. I chose rest as a focus. Actually, I was inspired by this amazing, incredible book, Rest is Resistance, A Manifesto, by Trisha Hersey, an amazing, amazing book where she really emphasizes, I honestly believe she's a bodhisattva just by the teachings in themselves too, a manifesto where she emphasizes the way that systems of oppression can really harm our psyches and bodies, and at the same time, how our bodies can also be the sites of liberation when you allow its spaces to really rest too. So she really contextualizes rest in the midst of this grind culture we're all a part of, and just how much our self-worth can be equated with what we do, our productivity, and just it's just incredible, just the wear and tear we all carry. And I was more referring to that wear and tear, just in that sense of that hopelessness that we're often kind of grabbed. So I really kind of connected with her teachings too. It really helped to connect the dots for me too, just around why this practice is important as well, particularly in viewing Zazen as a form of resistance. I almost kind of pictured it too, as it allows us to embody the principles of not holding to fixed views, bearing witness to suffering, and to act compassionately. And some of the ways Trisha Hersey recommends a sustaining a rest practice is, I also found it similar to the teachings we often receive around cultivating and embracing moments of joy. Mm. And that might be intentionally practicing, you know, she really recommends this daydreaming each day. Mm. Lying on your back on a patch of grass, just watching the clouds pass by. Taking a digital detox, et cetera, too, at the same time. But yeah, just her notion of using rest as a form of resistance and connecting that to my practice, I just found, it really, helped to put it in that context of hopelessness.
I feel that there can be like a whole other Zed talk around rest as resistance, so I appreciate you bringing that forward. There's a lot of depth there, and I know too, when we were talking, I had mentioned Lamarod Owen in his book, Love and Rage, the Path of Liberation Through Anger. And he talks a lot about the importance of tending to our grief and tending to our anger, which has been an important practice for myself. And he sees this also as a way of being compassionate to ourselves as we are tending to these things. And I know that, like Kate has offered during her Dharma talks, talking about opportunities to tend to grief. And I appreciate within Zen the rituals that we do have in that area. And I know for myself when, like, I don't tend to my anger or my grief, I experience the energies of anxiety and depression to begin with. So if I don't tend to those things, that just becomes less manageable. So I appreciate, having the opportunity to sit in Zazen, which is an embodied practice, the opportunity to be in community, which supports my practice. And I would also say, like, I consider my community my work community as well. So I work with a lot of great people who have been like an ongoing support. And, you know, I have the privilege of working with a lot of great folks on the Downtown East Side as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in a way that is, you know, part of refuge as well, you know, with the Buddha Dharma Sangha.
Really appreciate that too.
Okay, we're going to talk a little bit about Vicki Reynolds is somebody that you've been inspired by quite a bit. And one of the things I'm mindful of is whether we work on the front lines or not, whether we're a carer, activist, or just someone who cares about suffering in the world, it's easy to be pretty overwhelmed. And I know that I've felt like I can't do the work anymore and like I'm breaking down. And it can be easy to define this as burnout. And I say this because it's something that I've used to describe myself, and I've appreciated the work of Vicki Reynolds. She's works from a decolonizing and justice doing framework, and she works as a consultant and facilitator here in Vancouver and supervisor in team development. And rather than using the term burnout, she uses the term spiritual pain, which resonated for me. And she argues that the term burnout is individualistic, where somehow the person is not measuring up to the work or to the challenges. And spiritual pain really results from systemic inequities, the structural violence and limited resources that do not align with an ethic of care. So that was like, you know, that really resonated with me and helped me to make sense of, you know, some of what I was experiencing.
I really appreciated you just bringing up the work of Vicki Reynolds too. I want to really acknowledge how much I personally and professionally have benefited from Vicki's work and teachings too.
I also consider her a bodhisattva.
Thank you. I was thinking the same thing too at the same time. Yeah.
Someone who is working for the liberation of all beings.
That's actually a really great way of describing her work too. At the same time, somebody definitely with very limitless compassion, just what she embodies too, a fierce kind of compassion too. She's done a lot of work actually in bridging social activism, even with the land, whether it's with spaces of therapy and community work too. And she's written a lot of articles on this too, and in turn has found many ways to support frontline workers who work alongside especially people navigating very different systems of oppression too. As you had mentioned, Vicki speaks to the despair our workers often experience when their own ethics and values are violated by the larger systems they're accountable to in their work. And you can't help but feel despair and hopelessness and a kind of, I love her description of that spiritual pain when your own ethics that you carry inside are violated in a sense too by the very work you do too at the same time. How can you be in that space? Vicky mentions that she uses this term justice doing. She mentions that justice doing means doing dignity with people. I really love how she worked it. She uses it as a verb, not a noun, doing dignity. It means doing dignity with people looks by resisting, by witnessing or resisting accommodation to their oppression. She emphasizes we have to use our collective power to transform the social context that make these horrors of oppression and suffering possible. When we work in ways where we're enacting our collective ethics for justice doing, even though the work is hard and heartbreaking, we can have sustainability. The goal of our work is not to avoid heartbreak. I really love how she describes it, that the goal of our work is not to avoid heartbreak, but to be able to hold the person we work alongside at the center, even when we are heartbroken. This requires a lot of discipline in cultivating sustainability and hope. How do you do that? How? And I sit often with that too at the same time. One of the ways Vicky encourages us to maintain sustainability, to do this kind of justice doing in cultivating hope, is by drawing on what she calls, I love this term, solidarity teams. Mm-hmm. A solidarity team is it's an intentional group of folks who work as a network community that holds the worker up and accompanies them in the sites of ethical struggle and suffering in the work. It's a sense of community, a group where you're actually feeling shouldered up by people who can hold you accountable not only to your ethics, but are there for you in witnessing that spiritual pain as well. I actually belong to a solidarity group with Vicky too, and it really does support and sustains me too in this work, when I feel my hope is sliding too. Having people shoulder me up and make me accountable to my ethics, it centers the people I work alongside. And it also allows me to not only feel more hopeful, but to bring that hope into people's lives. I also find parallels, actually, in Vicky's ideas of connecting to a solidarity group as a way to center our ethics, and her notion of justice doing to taking refuge in the Sangha, as well as the ways we practice engaged Buddhism, too. It's a practice I'm very thankful that Mountain Rain opens to everyone here too. I see a lot of parallels in doing dignity and that kind of space. Ethical conduct is a pillar of my practice, and I'm fortunate that I have access to the Sangha and teachers such as Kate and Michael in offering spaces such as, whether it's Dokusan, who with their compassionate presence and wisdom, they often remind me of the importance of how do I uphold my own precepts in this space too, continually, despite what I'm often experiencing too. So that's really important.
Yeah, I know, not for myself, that I really appreciate you sharing that. It's been a gift for me to find a spiritual community that values engaged practice, and I've been heartened by this community where I can truly, where I can truly be a refuge for me. So that also opens that strengthens my hope muscle. So sometimes when I'm at home and don't have the opportunity to come into the center and I'm practicing by myself, I will visualize, you folks in my house. So as I'm practicing, so deep gratitude for this community. I'm really mindful that we are going way past time and we still have more to say. Is that okay? Okay, thank you. I wanted to share a quote from Rhonda McGee from a Dharma talk that she did at Upaya as part of Zen Brain 2017. And she's a professor of law and a mindfulness teacher. And in this talk, she was talking about surplus suffering, and I feel that this relates to what we're talking about and the folks that we work with and for. So in this Dharma talk, she says, how much is this suffering is not just existential or karmic, but surplus and social? And if there is surplus social suffering tied to historical patterns of privilege and disadvantage, what responsibility might arise out of deep contemplative practice. And this concept of surplus suffering and the responsibility of contemplative practice rang true for me. And I've always liked how Zen has been described as a practice of intimacy, as an embodied practice. And in our lives, we get to practice to live our ethics and vows to the best of our ability. And also when I think about this concept of surplus suffering, for me, it's also an invitation to create a deeper understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Yes, there is suffering, there is a root and ways to alleviate it, and an eightfold path that supports us to suffer less and live in right relationship with the earth and all beings. And there's those of us who experience surplus suffering. So this suffering, I see it as is beyond how the mind creates suffering, or suffering is connected to attachment or unhelpful desire, for example. There's surplus suffering exists in the context of dominant structures and powers and inequitable systems that continue to push folks to the margins of society. And as Vicki Reynolds frames it, we are working with people struggling for dignity, safety, and justice in the context of structural oppression. So when I think about my own work, self-reflective practice is important as a social worker, and as a social justice-oriented social worker, I know it's important for me to continually be aware of my own social location, areas of privilege and marginalization, and how this intersects with the folks that I work with. And whether, and at the same time, you know, I also acknowledge within all of this and the surplus suffering that I experience moral distress with ongoing systems failures that rob people of their potential and their lives. And part of my hope as a discipline too is reminding myself of the people out there who are continuing to do justice work, the resiliency of the folks that we serve who are not giving up, and that fuels hope as a discipline for me. And one thing we wanted to wrap things up with was talking about Norman Fisher's The World Can Be Otherwise, and how the Bodhisattva idea supports hope as a discipline. And Norman Fisher is a founding teacher of Mountain Rain, and he talks about the Bodhisattva path, the path of those in service of liberation of all beings, and the six perfections in this book. And I've been working on these perfections, these practices, which will be a lifelong practice. And he talks about one of the perfections, the practice of joyful effort, and he also weaves hope into this. And he writes that the Bodhisattva commitment is endless. The Bodhisattva job goes on and on, and the Bodhisattva's love and desire to be in service to others is limitless. In order to keep on with the work, Bodhisattvas practice the perfection of joyful effort. It's impossible to be a Bodhisattva without lots of energy, and you can't have lots of energy without limitless love for what you do. And I appreciate that he talks about this energetic activity in the pursuit of goodness, and that, you know, that it's important to be hopeful, and it's not this sort of foolish kind of hope. It's being clear and still being able to be. I think he sort of also describes Bodhisattvas as like the energizer bunnies of practice. So that is also something that's come to mind too in terms of the path of practice.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Go ahead.
That's right. Right here? Thank you. Forgot this here. It goes against striving. A joyful effort is an antidote to hopelessness or feeling defeated. It helps us to get into our own ethics to fuel the drive of what we love to do. Soft effort that just comes naturally. And this is what I really appreciate about, I think this, when you brought up that piece with Norman Fisher around joyful effort, I remember, just never used to describing effort with the term joyful before too. So effort in this context of other practices We often define effort in the context of being more productive, for example, or to get ahead, this kind of striving notion that's attached to it too. Joyful effort seems to be more with being rather than being against, which I kind of really appreciate or striving to.
And we are going to finish nice. With a brief meditation. So each time we come together, we do so as Sangha, the gift of community. So I invite you to take a moment to find a comfortable stationary form or position, standing, sitting, or lying down. And as you position yourself, please do so with kindness and care. This kindness and care is the foundation of practice. And as you are ready, take a moment to settle into your body, sensing that you have a body. And in your own time, begin to bring your awareness to your breath and the sensation of breathing. Please bring to mind or visualize a time in which you felt hopeful. And as you bring this moment to mind, see if you can notice how this feels in your body. How hope feels in your body. And if it's challenging to feel into the body, simply be aware of a time of experiencing hope. And stay with this awareness for a few moments. And know that this feeling of hope can be a resource for you whenever you need it. And in your own time, bring your awareness to your body, breath, and your awareness back to this space. Ding.
We could take a whole day and more to really go deeply into what you've shared with us, and so I really feel like maybe there are ways we can take this forward in Sangha and maybe open these kinds of practices and perspectives.